Hello, this is Wallace Kleindienst, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, and welcome to Rolling Stone. We continue to read from the April 2026 edition of Rolling Stone magazine, and we wrapped up all the random notes in the last edition of Rolling Stone, and we now return to the feature of the magazine this month, which is the future of music, the future 25 artists. Meet the artists who have us most excited about the sounds of tomorrow. And we first turn to Big Extha Plug. That's spelled B-I-G-X-T-H-A-P-L-U-G. The Dallas rapper built a career on swaggering bangers, then reinvented himself and invaded the country charts. But before any victories, he had to overcome a tumultuous past. Big Extha Plug is standing in front of his six-car garage, trying to decide which of his luxury SUVs to drive. We're outside his Mediterranean-style estate just north of Dallas on a windy January day, ready to hit the gym. Big X picks the Dodge Durango SRT Hellcat over the Cadillac Escalade V, which is getting detailed. He takes the wheel of the SUV and we drive through the countryside to a 24-hour fitness, blasting unreleased songs that Big X has recorded. They're motivational hip-hop anthems. His ear for choosing beats that fit his bellowing voice remains impeccable. In one, he shouts out both his kinfolk and 600 Entertainment, the independent label that he started under United Masters. Big X says, "I do it for my kids and my family, 600 niggas who stay down with me." When we arrive at the gym, we head to a multi-purpose fitness space where Shadow, Big X's personal trainer and bodyguard, leads a full-body circuit. With Pool Shiesty blaring from a speaker, Big X and the rest of us go through 30 seconds at each station, lunges, throwing a medicine ball up a wall, then slamming it on the ground, and dumbbell lateral raises, a cardio step-up workout, shadow boxing, and then more lunges. Nobody seems to notice that Dallas's most popular rapper is getting his reps in. Shadow suggests an ab workout. "That's overdoing it," says Big X. Shadow insists, "Just a little bit. You're going to lie on the floor." My client is my only human, says CJ Big X's younger brother. Shadow isn't taking no for an answer. "You're not dying," he says. "Physically I am," Big X says, as the pair are wrapped in laughter. "Mentally, I just know I'm not dying, so I'm not complaining. But physically, I'm going through it." Big X's nickname isn't a coincidence. The former college football player is still stout enough to compete on the gridiron. Nowadays, he works out 4 days a week, a routine he began last year. He changed his diet, dropping from around 470 pounds to 425 while regaining some muscle. Big X wants to hit his ideal weight, which is 350 pounds, so he can wear clothes that better show off his style. Big X says, "All I've been doing has been muscle memory from me playing football. So now I'm finally getting my body back right." Jelly Roll, his friend and collaborator on the 2025 track Box Me Up, recently underwent his own radical weight loss. I ask if he gave Big X any tips. "He's like my uncle," Big X says. "So anytime I'm around Jelly Roll, it's more like a bub. This is what I feel like you should do. I smoke healthier. I eat healthier. I walk every day. He's trying to put me on game." "If we're being honest," Big X admits, "I don't know why I'm in this gym. Like I said, I feel like I look good already. I know I'm healthy. I don't eat crazy, stupid shit. It's more of a mental thing. It's something I said I'm finally going to do." When Big X, age 27, sets his mind to something, he sees it through to life-changing results. Case in point, after years of making rap music brimming with raw authenticity and regional pride, he decided to release a full-on country rap album last year entitled I Hope You're Happy. Big X's country debut came at a time when the country rap crossovers are more popular than ever. Moneybagg Yo and Morgan Wallen's Whiskey Whiskey, Quavo, Luke Bryan and Teddy Swims' Georgia Ways, and Graham Borman's Oil Money come to mind. But Big X did something no other artist had done. The album's lead single, entitled All the Way, featuring country star Bailey Zimmerman, became the first song ever to top both Billboard's Hot Country Songs and Hot Rap Songs charts. A cross between the polished hooks of Nashville's Hit Factory and hip-hop's vivid street life tales, I Hope You're Happy introduced Big X to a new fan base and has allowed Big X to check off some impressive milestones. Billboard's Country Power Players Innovator, a Ryman Auditorium performance in Nashville, Tennessee, closing out the CMA Awards with Luke Combs, performing their song, Pray Hard. Big X made the album after a breakup, opened up about his feelings of resentment by exploring the heartbreak and whiskey ethos of country music. After several albums full of cinematic street rap, Big X spent more than a year and a half immersing himself in Nashville's meticulous songwriting process. He was learning to be vulnerable as a songwriter, pouring it out all of his emotions as a heartbroken narrator on the title track with Darius Rucker, which set the direction for the album. It was a risk to drop a country album, and Big X knew he might face ridicule for swerving outside of his lane. But his country appeal was always there, heard on songs like Texas, a 2022 track full of steel guitar, home state repping, and in the video, Big X rocking a cowboy hat, and his cameo on Shahoozie's Drink Don't Need No Mix. His pivot was met with little resistance, especially when Jelly Roll brought him out as a surprise guest at the country-dominated Stagecoach Festival in 2025. Luke Combs gave Big X some words of wisdom after he doubted his acceptance in country music. Big X remembers thinking, in my head, they can't be fucking with me for real. He says, but he was the one who was telling me, as much as you feel like they don't want you here, they want you here. So get that out of your head. Big X says he wants to be the best artist in the world. To him, this meant he had to venture outside of hip-hop. He's saying, you can't be one of the best artists in the world and have only done one genre. Beyonce, a GOAT, greatest of all time, a queen, Big X continues. She's done pop, country, Lil Wayne, rock, pop. Snoop Dogg did songs with Katy Perry and shit. All these people are great, from Eminem to Dr. Dre to Ice Cube. Everybody has stepped out of that lane. The album I Hope You're Happy marked the high point of his country era and the end of it. He vows that his next project will be a return to rap form, fueled by his competitiveness to conquer the genre that made him. He says, I just feel like right now I got unfinished business. I've done more in country than I have hip-hop-wise. Country Innovator of the Year, I've never been to the fucking BET Awards. The skies have turned gray and rainy as we head back to Big X's estate, part of a private neighborhood on acres of tranquil land. This is a multi-generational home. Big X's grandmother, Angela, his mom, Courtney, his son, Carter, and two-year-old daughter, Liani, whom they affectionately call Bird, all live here, along with three of his siblings. A massive island in the kitchen offers ample space for gathering, overlooking the woodscape and creek just beyond the back door. YouTube's videos of Big X's songs play on a mounted television that has an IKEA times Virgil Abloh keep-off rug underneath. Angela, a former bodybuilder, has portioned out food for everyone. Mashed potatoes with beef and corn, topped with gravy, along with a side salad on the counter. Lemonade Kool-Aid fills a pitcher. On a shelf sits a mini version of a platinum pack for Big X's 2023 album, Amar, next to a photo of him labeled Employee of the Month. There are paintings of Big X throughout the house, gifts from Fan. He is the centerpiece here, surrounded by his loved ones. Big X decides to hang back at home after the gym. Let me know he's going to disappear for a bit to shower. The rapper, who is generally in constant motion, has remained dormant this week after a New Year's Day shooting outside of an after-hours club where he was in attendance. Instead, Shadow, Courtney, Angela, and Big X's youngest sister, Zion, offer to take me on a tour of Forest and Pleasant Grove, the nearby neighborhoods that shaped Big X's music. As we pull into a gas station in the Escalade, Courtney and Angela start sharing stories of Big X's upbringing. Born Xavier Landon, he played football from age 5 to 18. It kept him out of trouble. He played on both the defensive and offensive lines and was strong enough to flip giant tires across the field at age 13. He was just that popular little boy, Courtney says. Everybody wanted to hang around him or fight him. They wanted something to do with him. So I knew he was going to be something. Whatever it was, he was going to be big. Then we got to the teenage years, and I just thought I failed, she says, laughing in a past life. Courtney dealt drugs. Big X's father, Bay, served time in prison for a stretch of Big X's childhood. We barrel down US 75 towards Ferris. In the front seat, Zion throws on recent Big X songs, Meet the Sixers and 600 Degrees. Courtney raps along. A few highway changes later, we get to the low-income housing unit where the family lived for 13 years in the 2000s. With nothing but brown flats, a grocery store, and gas stations within a walking distance, there's not much for distractions in Ferris. For Courtney, the housing offered a chance for some stability for her son. When they were little, Big X was maybe 9 and the girls were 6, 5, whatever. We would sit around and rap, Courtney remembers. My oldest daughter, she adds, would do the beat, and me and my son would battle it out. Never knew it was nothing serious, but he had something in him. So when he started rapping and he was cold, Courtney continues, I was like, ah, you got that from your mama. When Xavier was age 16, he'd be gone for the whole day, as Courtney puts it. She drives around looking for him and often would find him in the same spot, the 600 block of Meadow Ridge Street, which is where we head to next. This is where the neighborhood kids hung out, and it gave rise to Big X's label, 600 Entertainment. It'd be like 20 guys outside and you knew Xavier's in the middle of that circle, she recalls. Later, he'd shoot the mic drop performance of his 2021 track, Safe House Here. Courtney tells Shadow to head to South Buckner Boulevard. She recalls where she met Big X's dad and points out the apartment that she lived in when she was 18 and Big X was only 3. Next, she nods to an apartment building with neutral exteriors and an unassuming look. This is where she lived when Big X was between age 5 and 6. These are the apartments that he raps about on his standout track, The Largest. Safe to say I'm the biggest, the largest, been stepping on shit since my mama stayed in them apartments, regardless, as the song goes. Courtney has some regrets, namely that she struggled to pay rent and resorted to dealing drugs. She reminisces about the family's worst days. All I can do is laugh, she tells me. Half the shit you're going to have to turn that recorder off for. On my soul, I'm not playing. Angela chimes in. Courtney called me one day and said, the microwave isn't working. How do I heat my food up? I said, oh my God, she's never going to make it. But she did, and when he made it in rap, Big X made good on his promise to buy his mom a house, the one they all live in now. No matter what's going on in his life, one thing is clear. He takes care of his people. Angela mentions that she used to leave Big X voicemails that went unanswered, but she was delighted when she learned that one of them where she sees him shining and says she's proud of him, made it on the title track of the album Take Care, a top 10 album Big X released in 2024. He doesn't listen to them, she remembers thinking with a laugh. Zion turns the music up. Her brother's songs make for great cruising music as we head up 75 through rush hour traffic. Night begins to fall and we arrive back at Big X's house. Shadow backs into the driveway, careful not to run over the blue and white Christmas lights along the path. Up in his office on the second floor, Big X is streaming on Twitch, with Bay watching from the side and smoking a cigarette. Bay, also known as Pops, has a deep voice and still calls Big X his baby. When Big X was 9, his mom sent him to live with his dad after learning that he had been stealing money from her. May describes the hardships he had faced while reacclimating to life after prison, securing an apartment and finishing it for himself and his son, working 12-hour shifts to put food on the table. Still, he and his son found the energy to hold each other up. He took care of me just like I took care of him, Bay says. Bay encouraged Big X's talents early on. Like Courtney, Bay would start rhyming in the car, setting it up for his son to freestyle. He was impressed by his son's vocabulary. He says, I used to tell somebody, man, my son freestyles better than you all. And he'll start rapping and everybody be like, the fuck? This dude's too young to be real. He out-rapped them all. Midway through our conversation, Bay calls a friend who sends him the second song Big X ever made. It's from 2019, before Big X finally found his voice. It's two dudes that I know that can rap pretty good, and I put them on the track with Big X. He killed it, Bay brags, before adding, he doesn't even know I got this. Big X doubted his own talent at first, but Bay knew his son could make it to the big leagues. Bay plays a song on his phone, and Courtney comes in to listen with us. Big X's voice is drenched in auto-tune, far different from the thick baritone of his songs today. All the same, Mom and Dad nod along proudly. We leave Big X to plug, and the next artist to be spotlighted in the future of music is the artist Dee Spitz. Straight out of Austin, this punk band is playing loud, winning fans, and opening for the Foo Fighters this summer. When the email came in from their management last year telling them that they were opening for the Foo Fighters, Dee Spitz drummer Chloe D. St. Aubin screamed. She was seated next to her bandmate, guitarist Eleanor Livingston, trying to focus on homework for their online college courses, but the punk quartet they formed just a few years earlier was occupying both of their minds. Their absurdly high-energy live show and debut LP, Something to Consume, had won them a cult following, and they were quite ready to take the next step. We were spiraling, says Dee St. Aubin. I was like, we're not doing anything. What are we going to do? And then I checked my phone. They had secured that gig opening for the Foo Fighters at a 61,000-seat stadium in Liverpool this June, their biggest show ever. The road to this moment of triumph, one of many that they'll have this year, since he's also playing Coachella, Outside Lands, and Lollapalooza, began back in 2022 when Livingston, bassist Kate Halter, and guitarist Ava Scubrun were all attending the same high school in Austin. We were super into rock bands. We smoked a bunch of weed and liked to party, says Livingston. So we were like, we should start a band. After rounding out their lineup with Dee St. Aubin, they developed a ritual where they'd swap instruments every few songs and take leggy pop-like stage dives into the audience. They got signed to Jack White's Third Man Records last year after playing an SXSW showcase. I had the flu and was so ill, Livingston recalls. I was like, did I just die? And they were like, you all were awesome. These days they're playing to much bigger crowds and loving it. The beauty of playing for so many people is an energy that not many people experience, says Livingston, adding, especially when they know your lyrics and whatnot. It's like you climb to the top of a mountain. It's freaking better than sex. It's a crazy feeling. And the next artist to be spotlighted in the Future 25 is Wally the Sensei. Built in Compton, co-signed by Travis Scott and Kendrick Lamar. Raised on the west side of Compton, Wally the Sensei walked the same blocks that bred giants like Kendrick Lamar and The Game. But it took years of hard work, including a stint on a fishing boat in Alaska, before he decided to take music seriously around 2021. Wally got a major boost when Travis Scott signed him to his Cactus Jack imprint, an experience he likens to a lyrical boot camp. He says, "I worked every single day, 15 to 18 hours a day, and I just kept sharpening, sharpening, and sharpening," says a rapper, age 31. In 2024, he reached an even bigger audience when Lamar tapped him for a guest feature on GNX. And this spring, Wally is sharing his defining statement with his mixtape, Mad Dog. "It's an expression about people where I'm from," he says. "I feel like we came from a mad place." And the next artist to be spotlighted, Words of Azia, a modern GRIOT, spreading messages of hope in music that draws on her Ivorian heritage. In a dimly lit beauty salon in Paris, Words of Azia is seated with a bright smile across her face. A beautician gently fixes a new set of acrylic nails as we settle in for a chat. "My beauty regimen is not so complicated, but I like to have my nails done," Azia says. "I feel like it adds something when I'm playing the guitar." The French Ivorian, Ivorian, singer-songwriter born Nelly Azia Sadin finds beauty too in her ancestral Bété culture, a subgroup of the Creole people of Côte d'Ivoire, renowned for their energetic dance and songs. Raised in both her hometown of Sequoyah and Paris, Words of Azia immersed herself in her Ivorian heritage by watching her mother sing and dance. Her father was a vast collector of African music, exposing her to musicians like Nigerian legend Fela Kuti and Cape Verdean singer Cicera Evora. In college, she took a keen interest in Africa's pre-colonial histories, a rabbit hole that inspired her to weave Ivorian folklore and legends into her lyrics. On her 2025 debut album, Modern White Go, she mixes traditional Bété rhythms with a tinge of soul and jazz. The album is lush with West African instruments like the kora and djembe, and resonant with themes of heritage, spirituality, and hope. "In my last visit to my village, my mother asked me to scrape some soil into my hands and whisper a prayer to my ancestors," Azia says. "Moving forward, I want to tap into those rituals of celebrating things, of praying, of connecting with our land, and express that in my music." We next turn to Dexter and the News Agent, making eclectic dance pop in her South London bedroom. Dexter in the News Agent got her stage name from a joke at a party in high school. Someone was like, "What's her name?" And I said, "Dexter," because I thought that was so funny, she recalls. In the News Agent took a bit more brainstorming and came from the need to optimize her visibility in a sea of Google searches for a certain Showtime series. Born Charmaine Ayoku, this South London singer-songwriter had a major breakthrough with her 2025 debut mixtape entitled Time Flies, a bedroom pop project that nods to Pink Panthers and Claro. Raised by Nigerian parents near Brixton, she had a transforming experience seeing Solange back in 2019. Seeing that reminded me that anything's actually possible, and began making music during COVID lockdowns. She's a close friend of 2025 Future of Music honoree Jim Legacy, and a feature on his Black British Music album brought her new fans. Next up, a debut album of her own, Right now, she adds, I'm just trying to have loads of fun. And the last artist that we'll spotlight today in Rolling Stone's Future of Music, The Future of 25, is Raven Lenae. After years of hard work, Raven has a major R&B hit with Love Me Not, and Raven's aiming even higher for her next act. 2 years ago, in May 2024, Raven Lenae spent a warm evening playing to a sizable crowd at UC Davis in California. The college performance fell on the same day that she released the dreamy R&B single Love Me Not as the introduction to her second studio album entitled Bird's Eye. Obviously, nobody knew the song, Lenae, age 27, recalls now. And as soon as the drums came in, I saw the crowd completely shift. As she watched the audience's reaction, she thought to herself, there's something really special about Love Me Not. She was right. In April 2025, nearly a full year after its release, the song Love Me Not made it onto Billboard's Hot 100 at number 81. And by last summer, it jumped all the way to number 5. It's also been used in millions of posts on TikTok. When we finished that song, she says, I knew it was a big song. There's something about it that strikes every chord. At least for me, she says. It was just a matter of time. In fact, her breakthrough was years in the making. She signed to Atlantic Records back in 2016 as a bright-eyed 17-year-old and has been building towards this moment ever since. Now, as she puts the finishing touches on her third album, Raven Lenae is searching for the sweet spot between finding patience in the present and feeding her hunger for something new. The thing that people can expect from me every time is I'm going to try something different, even if I'm just twisting the knob slightly to the left, Raven says. Every single time, I'm going to challenge that last thing. We turn now to a feature story in this month's Rolling Stone magazine. ICE comes to the American heartland. After the government declares mission complete in Minneapolis, aggressive ICE occupation continues in small-town Minnesota. Magdalena fought hard for her American dream. Now it is dying on the side of a road near the Shakopee Hy-Vee supermarket. U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents surround her car with handguns and rifles drawn. They are all wearing masks. More agents swarm the car in front of her. It holds her two teenage daughters. They are both American citizens and are on their way to school. An ICE agent starts banging on her windshield. She doesn't know what to do. The agent with the rifle demands Magdalena's papers. Roll down the fucking window. He stares her down. Magdalena is frightened. All she can do is beg for her children. Let them go. They are citizens, please. Magdalena grew up in Mexico City. Those appearing in the story by first name only have had their names changed to protect against ICE retribution. Magdalena tells me that when she was 12, her mother crossed the border with her older brother because she feared her son would become entangled in gang violence in Mexico. Her mom came back for her 2 years later, and they both crossed the border into Texas. Mom and daughter split up after crossing the border, reasoning that traveling as a family made them more suspicious. She spent a week alone in a Texas border motel waiting for a ride to Denver. She often thanks God that nothing unspeakable happened to her. Around 2 weeks later, Magdalena was reunited with her mom and brother in a town called Shakopee, Minnesota, about 25 miles from Minneapolis. The main bridge over the Minnesota River into Minneapolis often floods over in the spring, making the journey into the city a 90-minute trip. But a new bridge was built high above the river back in 1996, and over a generation, the small town morphed into a suburb of nearly 50,000 people. Now it is every town USA, with a Panera, an Applesby, and a Wednesday night trivia contest downtown at Mana Brewing. None of that meant anything to Magdalena as a child. She just knew her friends were in Shakopee. That made it all the more surprising when, after a year, Magdalena's mom told her that they were moving to another town 10 miles away. Magdalena asked why. You're just hanging out with the other Mexican kids. You're never going to learn English here. So Magdalena moved to the new town where she and her brother were the 7th and 8th Spanish-speaking kids out of hundreds of students. Her mom's plan worked. Today she speaks impeccable English. She returned to Shakopee and fell in love with a man who arrived in Minnesota at age 15 under similar circumstances. But there was one difference. Magdalena had filed papers under the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals Act, known as DACA, that granted legal status and work permits for undocumented immigrants brought to America as minors. She now is legal. Her husband is not, despite being in Minnesota since the last century. They now have 4 children, all citizens. For decades, Magdalena kept a low profile, taking her daughters to dance class and helping new arrivals adjust to Shakopee life. She loved to read about her new country. Once she told a friend that her hero was Harriet Tubman, the former slave who went back to the America South to help others escape through the Underground Railroad. It's one thing to escape from danger, but to return to that danger and help others takes so much courage, Magdalena once said. Magdalena didn't want her 4 children to have her vagabond childhood, so they stayed put in Shakopee in the same mobile home community. Her husband ran his own business. Life was hectic, but it was good. Then in December, President Donald Trump sent thousands of ICE agents to Minnesota. The president raged that Somali-American fraud in Minnesota was a reason for the surge. Then why, Magdalena wondered, are there so many of the people being arrested Hispanic? And why, if the focus is Minneapolis, as the news reported, are there dozens of dark-tinted SUVs circling her neighborhood in Shakopee? Magdalena and her family took precautions. Her husband shuts down his business. She makes sure her girls have their passports with them at all times and begins following them on their 10-minute drive to Shakopee High School as an added precaution. As Magdalena tells it, it's just after 8 in the morning in mid-January, and the temperature is still below zero. Magdalena's girls load up their car for school. That's when Magdalena notices the silver SUV. She loads up her car, and the SUV slowly creeps ahead. She motions for the girls to drive. 3 more SUVs pull out of a parking lot and join the silver one. They tailgate Magdalena. She texts a neighbor and tells them to spread the word that ICE is in the area. Don't come out. The silver SUV pulls out of the caravan and speeds past Magdalena and her daughter's car. He throws on his flashing lights and forces the 2 cars off the road. The other SUVs pull up and box the 2 cars in. A half dozen agents stalk toward Magdalena's car. 2 of them pull handguns. A 3rd brandishes a rifle. Magdalena's first thoughts are for her girls. One of her daughters has special needs, and she knows that she will go to pieces. Agents bang on the girls' car windows. Magdalena can't focus. She sees her kids crying hysterically. The girls press their passports against the window. Magdalena doesn't want to think of what would happen if one of them had left her passport in another jacket. Please, I really have to go to the bathroom, please, one of her girls says. The girls are released after about 15 minutes. They drive away, and the agents focus on Magdalena. She cracks the window of her car and again asks why they stopped her. An angry agent manually forces her window all the way down. She's resisting. Get her out of the car. Magdalena refuses to move. The agents eventually tell her the car she is driving was linked to an undocumented citizen. This isn't true. It's registered to her stepfather, who is documented. She shows the agents her DACA paperwork. This doesn't mean anything. She refuses to give them the papers. She knows they have a habit of not returning them. Instead, Magdalena produces another letter from the United States government that states her DACA status prevents her from being deported. This fluxums the agents, and they make a series of calls. Eventually, the agents say she could be deported because of an old ticket she received for driving without a license back in the 2000s. This was from before she had DACA status. For a moment, Magdalena doesn't remember the ticket. The agent screams at her, "You're lying to us." Magdalena has visions of being hauled away to an ICE detention center and never seeing her children again. This isn't paranoia. The DHS admits in February to deporting 86 DACA recipients. She tries to focus. "I'm done talking. You're trying to trap me. I want to talk to my lawyer." Finally, another agent comes up. "She's okay. Let her go." Then Magdalena says something that she later regrets. "Thank you." Magdalena drives up to Shakopee High School, home of the Sabres. She parks and finds her daughters waiting in the office. They hug and fall to the floor, crying and shaking. In February, I asked Magdalena why she thinks they were stopped. "They saw my brown skin, that's all." I didn't hear hatred in her voice or in the voices of others targeted. They all just wanted one thing, to be treated like Americans. By the time I arrive in Shakopee, the town is in the second month of an ICE occupation. The media is focused on Minneapolis, but Shakopee is living through its own hell. Everyone is exhausted, from the kids at Sweeney Elementary missing their Hispanic friends, to the Abuela stuck inside her home since Christmas. Brad Tapke looks different too. There are dark circles under his eyes, and his beard is grayer than I remember. I first met Tapke, a state representative, 6 months ago at the Shakopee Bree Hall for a story on his friend and mentor, Minnesota House Speaker Melissa Hortman, who was murdered last June. After some tears, we make small talk, and I remark how the quaint Shakopee downtown reminds me of the Michigan town where I lived when I was in high school. Tapke used to be Shakopee's mayor, and gives me a you-don't-know-the-half-of-it grin. Not anymore. You can still get glimpses of these old Shakopee when you watch the Shakopee Sabres play hockey at the ice arena, where the boards are festooned with ads for Tommy's Malt Shop. There are downtown pubs serving craft ales to Paul Bunyan types. In a generation, the town is diversified, with 35% of the population classified as immigrants, mostly South Asian, Hispanic, and Somali, in that order. How we got from those demographic facts to ICE agents terrorizing teenage girls on their way to school is a window into the Donald Trump years and a policy of terror built on one lie that leads to more lies. Trump has convinced himself that he did not lose Minnesota 3 times in his presidential bids, but, wait for it, the elections were stolen from him. He despises Minnesota Governor Tim Walz, who was also the Democratic vice presidential nominee in 2024. On Thanksgiving evening, Trump called Walz seriously retarded for allowing, in his words, Somalian gangs to roam Minnesota causing mayhem. On December 1st, 2025, Trump sent more than 3,000 ICE agents into the state with the goal of eradicating the Somalian criminal element responsible for perpetrating fraud against the federal government in a series of healthcare scams. Trump's invasion was based on a shred of fact. The Minnesota fraud scandals are real, beginning with Feed Our Future, where $250 million was stolen from a fund earmarked to feed children during the pandemic. In 2022, 47 people were charged. Most have either been found guilty or made plea deals. The mastermind of the scheme was a white woman. In 2025, a federal prosecutor alleged that Somalian-led groups may have looted up to $9 billion from Medicaid programs. Trump claimed it was actually $18 billion and labeled members of the Somali community pirates. So far, the Minnesota Star Tribune newspaper lists the proven fraud amount to be just $200 million. Real scandal morphed into Salem levels of hysteria in December 2025. That's when right-wing influencer Nick Shirley shot video purporting to show closed sham daycare centers in Minneapolis that garnered 135 million views on X. None of Shirley's claims have been officially substantiated, but it didn't matter. Trump then moved thousands of ICE agents into Minnesota with the purported goal of capturing Somali fraudsters and deporting them. There was just one other problem with Trump's ICE surge. Somali Americans make up less than 2% of Minnesota's total population, and the overwhelming majority of them, law-abiding or criminally inclined, are American citizens or legal residents. Soon it became clear that most Minnesotans swept up in ICE raids were not Somali or the worst of the worst, as Trump and DHS Secretary Kristi Noem like to frame it. No, they were Hispanic people who have nothing to do with social welfare scams, real or imagined. In one way, Shakopee was already a right-wing influencer's dream. In 2021, an undocumented Cuban immigrant decapitated his girlfriend named America Thayer with a knife and left her body on a Shakopee street. He was acquitted due to mental illness and sent to a mental health facility. Any complaints about ICE tactics could be met online with grisly photographs and comments about Thayer's murder. The Trump administration started slowly in Shakopee, first notifying local factories that many of their employees did not have work papers. Some laborers simply stopped showing up to work. In early December, ICE vehicles circled school bus stops and predominantly Hispanic neighborhoods. That's when Tabaki and his wife Katie, a high school teacher, activated their connections. They held seminars on how Shakopee residents could help their besieged friends. The Shakopee resistance was non-confrontational. If law enforcement asked you to back up, you didn't confront them, you backed up and lived to resist on another day. If you want to be more aggressive and in their faces, there's other organizations, Tabaki told attendees. That's not us. The volunteers patrolled Shakopee's neighborhoods where ICE was hitting the hardest and packed and delivered groceries to 350 families. Not that all of Shakopee was on board. The town is the ultimate purple district. Tabaki was reelected by just 14 votes in 2024 after a contentious recount. Trump's aggressive attacks emboldened bigots in the community. Mary Hernandez runs Mia Casa, a nonprofit that delivers food and other goods to low-income families. In December, she was leaving Shakopee's Chipotle, and a woman threw a soft drink at her, screaming, "Go back home." Another member of her team was collecting toys for a Christmas toy drive when a man shouted, "Why are you in my country?" In January, a woman was arrested in Shakopee's Cub Foods parking lot after screaming ethnic slurs and curses at a Hispanic woman and leaving on her a note on her car saying she was reporting her to ICE. "Trump gave people permission to be cruel," Hernandez tells me. "I don't realize until much later that the first person Tabaki introduces me to in Shakopee is Mary's daughter, Ashley Gomez, a sweet college student. She has sad eyes and looks tired from helping her mother run Mia Casa. She is an American citizen like her mom." "I only go out for school," says Gomez. "I'm afraid. What if I get pulled over and forget my passport? I don't even want to go to one of those detention centers, even if it's just for a few hours. I have anxieties. Bad things happen to women there." She shrugs and seems to shrink inside her hoodie. "That should not happen in my country." Not everyone in Shakopee embraces Tabaki's non-confrontational advice. Luis Ramirez is going through his daily ritual outside of La Flor de Jalisco, his mom's restaurant and market in Shakopee, located next to a coin laundromat and across from a pawn shop. He steps out onto the cracked pavement in the parking lot and shouts at an SUV with an ICE agent behind the wheel, "Get the fuck out of here." The agent puts the car into drive and shouts back, "I hope you've paid your taxes." Ramirez shouts, "You're a piece of shit." As the SUV peels out, he steps back into the restaurant and locks the doors, an odd move since it's a lunch hour. "Customers knock, and if we recognize them, we'll let them in," Ramirez tells me. He smiles, "Sometimes someone thought you were an ICE agent, but I told them that you're okay." Ramirez is intent on making La Flor de Jalisco an island of safety. He has largely succeeded. Nearly every Spanish-speaking source suggests that we meet at the restaurant that Ramirez's mom opened up 6 years ago. Still, the place is only half full, the customers eating their food quietly in a dining room decorated with the portraits of Pancho Villa and Emilio Zapata. Ramirez says that before ICE, there would be a line out the door at lunchtime. All the construction sites shut down, and we got really slow, Ramirez says. In his 30s, with fierce brown eyes, he has three kids, but still looks like he gets carted at the liquor store. In January, Ramirez saw on a friend's live Facebook feed that ICE had two construction workers trapped on the refuge of a half-built house about 4 miles away. He jumped into his truck and a few minutes later pulled up at the work site. Ramirez went up to the second floor where an ICE agent was pointing a gun at a construction worker, balancing himself precariously on the half-built roof with a rope tied to a post down below. The agent pulled on the rope. Fearing the worker was going to fall from his wobbly perch, Ramirez grabbed the rope to steady it. Within seconds, Ramirez was swarmed by three agents. They punched him in the ribs, hogtied his feet and hands, carried him downstairs, and threw him into an SUV. An agent shouted at him, "You're looking at a bunch of felonies for assaulting an officer. What's your name?" Ramirez told the agent he never touched anyone and wouldn't give any ID until he was charged. The agent tried another tactic. "I'm going to pepper spray you right now." Ramirez told him to go ahead, but the agent didn't spray him. The SUV came to a stop, and the driver made some calls. A few minutes later, the agents told Ramirez they're going to let him out at the La Flor de Jalisco. Bruised and shaken, it took about 30 minutes for him to realize the possible reason why ICE cut him loose. "Rene Good had just been shot," he tells me. "I think someone told them to let me go because of that." Since then, Ramirez had made it his mission to protect his mom and her business. Every day, ICE returns and takes down the license plates of every car in the parking lot, and every day Ramirez tells them to fuck off. "They want to come after the criminals? Go ahead," says Ramirez, "but they're going after customers and my mom's business, and that's not right." Then his mom, Francisca, walks over from the cash register. She's a very tiny woman and lightly puts her hands on her son's shoulders. I ask her if she's worried about her boy. She responds in Spanish, "Of course." Then she smiles a little, but I'm also proud. It was a still black night in Socopi when I met Linda Simmonstad in the parking lot of an apartment building. We arranged to meet there at 6:45 in the morning so I could ride along with her observing ICE activity. I rolled down my window and gave a wave. She doesn't wave back. Instead, she calls my out-of-state license plate into her dispatcher and has it run through a database of known ICE vehicles. This happens to me multiple times while in Socopi. Only then does she drive over to me. "Sorry about that," says Simmonstad, a 40-ish age teacher. "ICE has done some crazy things, and we're all a little scared." Tabaki has had his truck plates run multiple times by ICE while observing and has arrived home only to find an ICE vehicle sitting in front of his house. A DH spokesperson said ICE did not follow a state representative to his home. One night, a helicopter hovered over his home. Drones crisscrosses his neighborhood after dark. Then there is Steve Staff. He's a strawberry blonde, middle-aged professional who would not look out of place in an Eddie Bauer catalog. One morning, he was in his truck observing an ICE vehicle from a block away. Suddenly, an ICE SUV pulled in front of him, and four agents jumped out and shouted, "We will find out where you live," he remembers one saying. "We will shoot you in front of your house." The terror in Socopi conjures up the Buffalo Springfield song For What It's Worth, with the lyrics, "Paranoia strikes deep, into your life it will creep. It starts when you're always afraid. Step out of line, the man comes and takes you away." Well, that wraps up the feature story on ICE in the homeland. We now turn to the last word, spotlight on Melissa Etheridge and her interview. The 2026 Rock and Roll Hall of Fame nominee on Country Rock Crossover, writing through grief, medical cannabis, and staying true to herself. And the interview. Question: having Shooter Jennings produce your new album was inspired. It sounds like classic Melissa Etheridge. How did you link up? Etheridge: I was looking for a producer who could walk the line between rock and country. I looked at his work and thought, oh yeah, I'm a big fan of his father, being Waylon Jennings. I think that he's an LA guy who got this heavy metal rock background, but is also very rooted in that country rock sound. We met, talked, and boy, did we get it on. I knew, Shooter Jennings, this is the guy. Question: your duet with Chris Stapleton on the soberly hopeful The Other Side of Blue. Is there a black story? Etheridge: sometimes you just have to work up the nerve to ask. I had never met him, but I was a massive fan. I went to Nashville where he records in Dave Cobb's studio. It's a huge historic soundstage. It was just me and him talking about our families. I spoke about my three surviving kids and mentioned Beckett, who I lost to addiction issues in 2020 when Beckett was just 21. Chris Stapleton said, oh, you talk in song. Within 15 minutes of sitting down, we were deep into writing. It was magical. Question: has country music helped bring rock back? Etheridge: yes, I think country is the place. I find myself turning on Sirius XM in a car, stations like Outlaw Country or The Highway. Then you listen to these artists and they sound like 90s rock and roll artists. I did grow up on Tammy Wynette and Johnny Cash, but I always stood more in the rock and roll world, but I don't know anymore. Question: spoken like someone who made the shortlist for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Etheridge: the Rock Hall is part of that. There was that classic rock and roll that we know, and then there's everything that has been influenced by it and has that rock and roll spirit. That's your R&B, rap, and country. Question: that runs counter to what Gene Simmons said in February, specifically, quote, it's not my music. I don't come from the ghetto. Hip-hop does not belong in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, close quote. Etheridge: that says more about him than anything. Rock and roll is a feeling. You can't bottle up and say, this is mine, not yours. Question: you've written through a lot, illness, grief. Has there been an evolution in the vulnerability you present in your songs? Etheridge: the writing was always the healing. Early on, it was love, heartache, that awful stuff that happens to you in your 20s. When I came out, there were no parts of me that were like, I can't talk about that. After cancer, it was, I'm going to write songs for me so that when I perform them 20 years from now, I'm going to feel my strength. And then, losing my son. The first song that I wrote for this album was entitled Call You. It had been 4 years since Beckett passed, and I still miss being able to call him. I wrote that, and then I was able to dig deep into the rest of the album. Question: as a breast cancer survivor, you've advocated for cannabis use. What happened to your line of botanicals? Etheridge: I've given up on the cannabis business. When I jumped in 10 years ago, I thought it was going to be legalized in the next couple of years. But it's still not federally legalized, and you really can't run a business without federal banking support. I sunk a whole lot of money into it. Now I focus my energy on my foundation, which funds research into plant medicine for trauma and addiction. That includes cannabis, psilocybin, and psychedelics. Question: Have your views on addiction changed since your son Beckett's passing, Etheridge? I always thought of addiction as deeply psychological and neurological. The more I experienced plant medicine, the more I felt confident that this is a good thing. When Beckett needed help, I wished there was a place I could take him to experience plant medicine. But he was underage, and there was no such thing. So when he passed, I said, I want to find a way to change the laws so we can have this as an option for addiction. Question, is Melissa Etheridge still you, or is it a persona? And she laughs. Melissa Etheridge is me. I've never put anything out there that wasn't me. My music may seem intense, heartbroken, angry, but if you know me, then you know it's all authentically me. And the final question, if your 23-year-old self were heading into the studio for the first time today, what would you tell her? Etheridge, whatever I'd tell myself, I wouldn't listen to it. I was a stubborn 23-year-old, but I would say, it's about the long run. You're going to have hits, and you're going to have albums that no one hears of. Just keep making music you love, and keep performing live. Keep on the path of making music and performing music, and you'll have a lovely, long, delicious career. Also, I tell myself to do more sit-ups. Well, that wraps up the interview with Melissa Etheridge. And this wraps up the April 2026 edition of Rolling Stone magazine. And this wraps up today's Rolling Stone. This is Wallace Kleindienst, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Thank you so much for listening.